By examining Rousseau and what has been termed his romantic philosophy, we can more deeply understand the important moral shift that has occurred in America in the past few decades. Rousseau was a deeply strange man. It has been said of him that he labored under the illusion that changes within his own life mirrored the great transformations of Western civilization. Some have accused me of operating under the same delusion. Many aspects of Rousseau's thought are misunderstood. Upon receiving a copy of Rousseau's Discourse on the Origin of Inequality, Voltaire wrote to him, "The desire to walk on all fours seizes one when one reads your work. Unfortunately, I lost that habit more than 60 years ago." Even today, the popular impression is that Rousseau wanted us to abandon civilization and live the life of a noble savage. But Rousseau explicitly disclaims any such intention. "Although I want to form the man of nature," he writes, "the object is not to make him a savage and relegate him to the depths of the woods." So too, many people misunderstand Rousseau's concept of the general will as constituting some kind of an apologia for totalitarianism. In fact, Rousseau was a champion of radical freedom. We can see this by focusing on a central element of Rousseau's thought, the one that pertains to the new morality of the 1960s. The philosopher Charles Taylor, whose interpretation of Rousseau I rely on throughout this chapter, expounds Rousseau's new idea. "There is a way of being human that is my way. I am called upon to live my life in this way and not in imitation of anyone else's. If I do not, I miss the point of my life. I miss what being human is for me." By insisting that each of us has an original way of being human, Rousseau is articulating the idea of individuality. But he is doing a lot more than that. Rousseau insists that in determining the unique course of one's life, the self is sovereign. To the American founder's list of freedoms, Rousseau adds a new one, inner freedom. In its most important manifestation, inner freedom is moral freedom, the freedom to determine what is good. But inner freedom also encompasses the broad range of choices that make one's life richer and more fulfilling. Rousseau argues that in deciding what to become, whom to marry, how to live, I should not go by the dictates of my parents, or my teachers, or my priests, or even God. I should decide for myself alone. How should I decide? By digging deep within myself, by consulting my inner compass, what Rousseau calls the interior guide that never abandons us. For Rousseau, we are beings with inner depths. "The principle of truth," he writes, "is engraved in all our hearts, and to discover what is right in a given situation, all we have to do is commune with oneself." As the Savoyard vicar puts it in Rousseau's Émile, "I do not derive these rules from the principles of high philosophy, but I find them written by nature in ineffaceable characters at the bottom of my heart." Here Rousseau is giving expression to the idea of authenticity, of being true to oneself. It is a massively important idea. Before Rousseau, no one believed that each human life should follow its own distinctive moral course, nor did anyone think of giving the inner self, the voice of nature within us, final authority in determining that course. Rousseau's view emerged in resistance to an earlier view, according to which morality was a matter of costs and benefits. For Rousseau, calculation is the ethic of the bourgeois, the man of commerce. "Ancient politicians incessantly talked about morals and virtue," Rousseau writes. "Those of our time talk only of business and money." Rousseau's objection to the bourgeois is that he is a bit of a low character. His main goals are to improve his financial situation and move to a nicer neighborhood. The bourgeois wants to look good, smell clean, and have regular bowel movements. Medical checkups are a big thing with him. He wants to postpone death as long as possible. The bourgeois is far more concerned with his portfolio than with his soul. He spends all day doing corporate accounts or selling pest control products, yet he is satisfied in his work. But how can one derive satisfaction from recording transactions all day or from killing rats and cockroaches? The bourgeois is a man of limited horizons. However picayune his function, he is proud of his work ethic. But as Oscar Wilde once noted, to have to do laborious work, like sweeping floors and adding up numbers, is depressing enough. To take pride in such things is absolutely appalling. Rousseau's strongest complaint against the bourgeois is that he professes to be moral while acting like a mercenary. His virtues are entirely based on selfish calculation. He treats other people well in order to make a bigger profit. The bourgeois man doesn't care about being good. He only wants to appear good. His overriding concern is with his reputation. And in his social life, the bourgeois is obsessed with foolish vanity. Even his opinion of himself is derived from how he is perceived by others. His personality is so shaped by convention that he no longer knows who he really is. He is estranged from his own nature. He is a faker and a hypocrite. Even worse, he is not free, because all his priorities, and indeed his very identity, are dependent on others. The conformity of the bourgeois is the mark of his unfreedom. Rousseau's charges are precisely the ones that the young people of the 1960s launched against their parents. Against the false values of the bourgeois, against his artificiality and hypocrisy, Rousseau offered the alternative of primitive man, natural man, of Homo sapiens before the advent of civilization. Rousseau admits that natural man may never have really existed. He is a kind of mental construct, a hypothesis. Nevertheless, Rousseau finds it very illuminating to imagine what such a man might be like. He would be a savage, yes, but a noble savage. His selfishness would be confined to meeting his immediate bodily needs. Confronted by suffering on the part of his fellows, natural man would feel pity. Natural man is not virtuous, he doesn't even know what that is, but he does have a basic innocence and goodness. Natural man is without vanity or pretense, the evils that Rousseau believes have been introduced by civilization. Rousseau also admires natural man because he is free. He has no prescribed duties, obeys no one, and follows no law other than his own will. Still, Rousseau is under no illusion that modern people can recover natural man. Having been imbued with civilization, we cannot now return to the forest and live with the bears. But if a return to nature is impossible, Rousseau argues that there is a second option available to us. We can recover the voice of nature in us. If man's original home cannot be restored as a place, it can be restored as a state of mind. Charles Taylor terms this self-determining freedom. In Taylor's words, "I am free when I decide for myself what concerns me, rather than being shaped by external influences." Our moral salvation comes from recovering authentic moral contact with ourselves. Self-determining freedom demands that I break the hold of external impositions and decide for myself alone. It is only when the layers of artificiality and convention are removed that one's true self emerges. For Rousseau, the true self is characterized by originality, sincerity, and compassion. He makes virtues out of all three. In his Confessions, Rousseau writes, "I am not made like any of those I have seen. I venture to believe that I am not made like any of those who are in existence." Rousseau proves the point by giving us an autobiography like none that was written before him. Commenting on Rousseau's revelations, Irving Babbitt writes, "Never has a man of such undoubted genius shown himself so lacking in humility and decency." Rousseau raises the curtain on all kinds of forbidden experiences, including masturbation, adultery, voyeurism, visits to brothels, even incest and sadomasochism. Far from being embarrassed about discussing such topics, Rousseau revels in them.